Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome to Nightlight, everybody. Glad you could spend time with me today because I have a really fascinating author with me again. She is definitely, this is her third time with me, and if she keeps writing, you know, she's going to become a real regular on the show, that's for sure. Before we start, though, I want to thank Ken Quiethawk for his amazing intro. Please look for him on the internet. He is a native storyteller, and the tradition that he is emulating and living in his life is one that all of us should be aware of, because it's a different way of preserving a cosmology and a history, and one that everyone should actually be aware of. I have with me today Dina Miriam, who has written a new book called When the Bright Moon Rises, The Awakening of Ancient Memories. It is first and foremost a love story between the sages of the cosmic forces known as the deities, love of the sages for the people, and love between individuals seeking to express this universal force of love that exists within all of us. It's also a study of karma, the cosmic law of cause and effect. This narrative begins in Vedic India around the 9th century BCE. With the meeting of two people and the seeding of a love that cannot be fulfilled, but which comes into fruition nearly 10,000 years later during the Tang Empire in China, where they are reborn as the renowned poet Li Bai and his poet wife. The awakening of her memories of previous births initiates an inner struggle that is only resolved under the guidance of her dearest master, her Taoist master, sorry about that, and this is her story. Dina is an author, storyteller, and the founder and convener of the Global Peace Initiative of Women, bringing spiritual resources to address critical global challenges such as conflict, social justice, and ecological scarring of the earth. Over the years, she has worked to bring greater gender balance and balance between the Abrahamic and Dharmic-based religious traditions for a more inclusive interfaith movement. Her two previous books, which I highly recommend and I loved, My Journey Through Time, A Spiritual Memoir of Life, Death, and Rebirth, and then The Untold Story of Sita, An Empowering Tale of Our Time, bring you into an understanding as to the tradition, the new tradition that Dina has initiated. And someone wrote a while back that this may well be the beginning of a whole new literary tradition, with people chronicling the journey of their spirit through time and their past lives and the lessons that were taught and the talents and the skills and the gifts that were brought forward. So, without further ado, welcome to the show, Miriam.
Thank you, Barbara. It's wonderful to be here again talking to you.
Well, you write about a topic that has fascinated me forever. And I think everyone has always, you know, hoped that they had past lives. Frankly, I truly believe that we have. And if indeed we have had, what kind of talents, skills, and inclinations we bring from one lifetime to the next. And even if we don't believe in past lives, the fact that we have inclinations and we have talents and skills would indicate that somewhere along the line there was more information in this particular area that is sending you in that direction again this lifetime. I'm a gardener. I can't stop gardening. You know, just even if you don't give me land, I'll fill pots with dirt and I'll garden. And it has to have been from past lifetimes that this love of nurturing plants took seed and has followed me lifetime to lifetime, I would think.
For sure.
So,
you know, when most people think about past lives, they think just of their personality just previous to this, their birth just previous to the current one. And they think of what happened in their previous birth as affecting things today, relationships, work, et cetera. When I wrote my first book, it was over a period of a number of years where I relived my birth just previous to my current one, and I thought that was the end of it. And then things happened in my life where I was back in the birth previous to that, and then I thought that was the end of it. And then I went back until I actually had relived seven lives sequentially, going back in time about 500 years. And that astounded me. It was like, wow. I mean, it's hard enough, you think, just to go back one life. But when I saw the pattern of seven lives, and I saw that it's a continuing saga, and there are things about me that are from a life three or four lifetimes ago, and so that I'm a compilation of all that came before. And I thought that was the end of it, because for a number of years I didn't see anything more. And then I took a trip to India, and I found myself back in time several thousand years. And I wrote the story, The Untold Story of Sita, which was memories of a higher age when there was much more harmony on the planet, harmony with nature, harmony among the humans. It enabled me to peer into what a higher age looked like and felt like. And again, I couldn't imagine going any further back in time. But then, sure enough, a year or two later, I found myself back in this ancient time about 10,000 years ago in the Vedic, the time when the Vedas were first being given a higher age even than during the time of Sita and Ram, what we would call the Isasata Yuga, the age of complete, direct perception of truth. And so I didn't know what to make of that, but that's where this story has its beginnings. This love story have its beginnings, and I was able to experience what that age was like when human society was just kind of undergoing a dramatic change, and it was going through growth. The ice was melting, which was very interesting to me too. It was a time about 11,000 BCE or 10,000 BCE, a comet hit the Earth and the glaciers melted. Previous to that, a big part of the Earth was under glacier cover, but the oceans rose 400 feet. Within, I don't know, they don't say what the time frame was, whether it was rapid or not, but certainly over a few centuries. And that was interesting because it created human migrations, and it actually laid the foundation for civilization as we know it, because rivers came when the glaciers melted, and then human society gravitated to the rivers, agriculture was developed. So human society took a new turn with the melting of the glaciers. And so then I wondered, well, we're at a similar point where our glaciers are melting. Will human society take a new turn? Will a whole new chapter open for us? It was interesting to go back to that time when society was also the world was at a crossroad as we are today.
Yeah, and it begs the question. You're talking about the Younger Dryas time frame, and I have always wondered, you know, what happened before. And, you know, there were parts of the country that were never under the ice caps because the polar ice cap over thousands of years changed radically in different places. And at one point, Antarctica was Garden of Eden-ish. It was a tropical zone.
Yeah.
And South America never had ice in it, and therefore those cultures probably go back even further without an interruption of the ice age. So, I mean, there's, you know, you've got a tremendous time frame you can play with your past lives, for sure.
Well, my current book goes back even further because I think there's no end to how far we can go back. We've been around for a long, long time in so many different forms. And of course, it changes your whole sense of identity. After writing my first book, it was like, well, who am I? Am I that one or that one or that one or this one?
I think that's one of the fascinating things about your past lives is that the personality changes as well. I mean, you know it's you, but the personality and the either the forcefulness or the timidness in many ways, the characters that you were are not reflective of the character that you are now. So you're seeing, you know, yourself with different personalities to a great extent and being able to sort of see where certain of your tendencies come from, which I think is fascinating.
It's absolutely true. I mean, I'm no longer the person I was a few thousand years ago because I've had a lot of life experience and I've grown and hopefully gained some wisdom. But there are things, like you said, gardening, there are things that remain with you, themes that continue to resonate through your lives, through a series of lives. Certainly relationships, powerful relationships stay with you. And so it's interesting because you get to see what's ephemeral, what really is not an intrinsic part of you. I mean, of course, once you get deeper into it, we're just pure spirit. There are things that tend to stay with us over several lifetimes, and so that's interesting to see. In the current book that I'm working on, that I'm just about finished, I got to see an aspect. It was actually the first time that I've written about myself in a male body, which was interesting.
Ah.
It's the first time I saw myself, I experienced myself in a male body, and you know, it didn't make any difference. I was still me.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting to have that experience of seeing myself in a male body. I mean, I've not that person anymore.
In a male body, you had a different sort of power than you do when you're in a female body. So that must have been interesting to experience.
Exactly. That was definitely. I had more freedom at that time to maneuver through the world because it was that takes place about 1000 BCE. When there already was, women already were second-class citizens in most parts of the world.
Uh-huh.
I mean, going back to the Vedic time where the bright moon rises, it was a time before that when women led clans, women were leaders, there was no restriction, really. The only restriction was not going against the laws of harmony within the society, which, of course, the personality that I had then did. She fell in love with a celibate monk and had some difficulty with that.
I had to laugh. It's sort of like, you know, when I was laughing and only because, you know, how frustrating to, you know, and clearly the feelings were shared, and yet the vow of celibacy took prominence. So that, you know, it, You know, she should have watched her mouth when she threw her beads into the river and said 10,000 years ago. Holy mackerel. It was kind of like, you know, be careful what you wish for in state because, you know, chances are you're going to live it out.
Well, words have power. And that's one of the things about that era is that they understood that words had power and that word is sound is vibration and vibration manifests. I mean, it has an enormous power within it. The interesting thing for me about that period is as the earth was changing, because forests were coming, because there was so much of the water was locked in ice, there was not a lot of rain. But suddenly now the water's released and there's rain and there's forests and, you know, life is thriving, right? But it was the rishis, the ones who understood the power of sound, who were helping with the transformation and the creation of all of that, quietly, silently. Doing their work.
I think one of the things that that I have always believed, and you know, you're certainly with what you're writing, kind of gives a confirmation to that. I have always believed that there was a time when we lived in harmony with the animals, where we could really talk to them, where there was there was communication between us and the animals, and I certainly believe that that's certainly something that happens today. I know I have cats, and, you know, I can go kitty, 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 but, you know, and if they hear it, they kind of know the rhythm, and they food is imminent. So, but you can actually send messages telepathically to your animals in pictures, and they will pick up on it and respond to it.
Well, that's it. A lot of the communication in those days was telepathic.
And so,
with the animals,
And so I, you know, there were no predators or anything. It was there was a balance in nature, so that there was no need for predatory stuff. It was a time of peace, and I don't know how far back this goes, but I have seen places where, you know, the animals and the humans worked together in Congress. You know, it was not a matter of now, we're not talking dinosaurs here, but we're talking a time in which there were lions and tigers and bears, oh my. And
it's in the collective memory. You know, in the West, we talk about the Garden of Eden, where there was harmony, you know, where man lived a natural life, man and women. So I think there is in the collective memory this time. In the East, we would say that was a Satyayuga. Before man began to see himself as separate and develop this consciousness of domination, where he saw himself as an integral part of the whole, took what was needed. It's interesting to me because some of the reviewers have looked at that part of the book. They call it a primitive society. And when you look at the way archaeologists and anthropologists look at that time period in the human frame, the time period of 8,000 years BCE, right? They see it as more primitive. But there was no war. There was no torture. There was no slavery. There was no treatment of animals the way we treat animals today, which is horrific, the way we treat animals. The whole meat industry, the way we just treat them like commodities with no consciousness at all. So I consider that to be a higher consciousness because there was a much greater sense of value of life.
Oh, absolutely.
And our place in the universe.
Not only that, when they came out of the forest and they came into a more organized civilization, they were told, you know, find out what what kind of talents and skills you have that you enjoy, and that's the area you go to. So so it was not a matter of you're assigned to do vegetables this week and wash dishes next week. It was, you know, where are you going to be able to contribute with joy? And that's the way they were drawn. And
there's also a lot of
beautiful
gratitude to the rivers, gratitude to the sun. I mean, you know, we think of it as primitive, worshiping the sun, but it was gratitude. Gratitude for all the forces of the natural world. And we've totally lost that in our society. I mean, we've commodified everything, we've deadened everything, we've taken the life out of everything, and we're heading toward destruction unless we can recapture some of those important guidelines for living.
Well, we've taken ourselves away from the Earth Mother. We've isolated ourselves with concrete, with wood, with shoes. I mean, there's a book out there called Earthing, and it talks about, you know, getting your bare feet in touch with the earth so that you can synchronize your heartbeat with the heartbeat of the earth. And when you do that, you know, you have a greater sense of peace. Not only that, but you're healthier.
Absolutely.
Because you're in sync with your environment. Now, certainly I'm not telling people in Alaska to go out and, you know, stand on the snow, but you know, there is this element of reconnecting to the Earth Mother, because when you get your heartbeat in sync with that heartbeat, there is a greater sense of oneness that fills you with joy and enables you to have a more abundant life, I believe. So,
but I think that they know that there are healing properties that come from the earth, just like there are healing properties in the soil. There are healing properties in water, sunlight. I mean, when you're living in harmony with it all, it's a much greater sense of well-being and health. Much less disease as we have it today. It's only when you fall out of harmony and begin to step over the natural laws, discard them and not value them, that all of the problems arise.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, you want to get back to your books too, because I think that your books really I think you have integrated into them trigger words that are going to send people into looking in other directions within their own lifetime. And one of them is the mantra and the sound vibration. And at one point, your sister, in which lifetime, I'm not sure, I think it was the first one, was given a mantra to be able to go between dimensions, is how
right.
I took it.
That's exactly
it.
It's between dimensions, into other dimensions, right.
Okay.
But it had to be used for the... not for personal reasons, but for the greater
right.
good, and she used it for a personal reason.
Well, frankly,
for
I
desire.
Think she was smart to stay where she was. She had a good family, and she was well loved. I mean, you know, it did separate her from her own home and family, but she lucked out.
She did luck out. She did luck out. Actually, there's more about her in some of the karma that was unfinished in that lifetime. Gets completed in the book that I've just finished. But the interesting thing about When the Bright Moon Rises is that while my other books collapsed time for me and showed how time is really a mental construct, we can find ourselves in any period simultaneously in several periods. But in with The Bright New Moon Rises, I found that the same thing happened with space. I found myself... I call it the celestial world, but really we're talking about other dimensions. Today we would call it other dimensions. We would say the celestial world is another dimension, right? And there are many other dimensions, some of them more beautiful, some of them, you know, filled with the same kinds of things here on Earth. But I found myself, there are three episodes in the book that take place in the other dimension. It begins there, and then there's an interlude, and then at the end it ends back in the other dimension. And so that was very powerful for me, because after that, since that time, I have found myself being able to access that other dimension. We live in a multidimensional universe. We are multidimensional beings, and we have closed ourselves off from that reality, from that part of ourselves. But it doesn't have to be that way. We can open ourselves and be aware of our existence in other dimensions, our relationships in other dimensions, and be of service in those other dimensions while we are still here in our physical bodies. And that was new for me.
Well, yeah.
That was a new experience.
Well, you know, there is no such thing as time on the other side.
That's right.
Time is something, you know, we have created, I don't know, to keep our perspective, I guess. But then there is no time on the other side.
In the ultimate sense. We've created it as a way to order our life.
Right.
You know, we've made it a sequence of things as a way of ordering our experiences, our physical experiences. But it has reality.
Exactly. And I want to go back to your sister in that lifetime was given a mantra to be able to go into another dimension. Now, lots of people are given mantras to chant, to, and it's a vibrational thing, and lots of people have worked with solfeggio music and things like that, which is frequency and sound. And so how would someone today seek to use a mantra to access another dimension? Would it be through meditation? Would it be through chanting? Would it be through how?
I think that one has to be pure in one's intention. The danger in all of that, I mean, mantras are often misused for personal gain.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like that movie that came out, The Secret. You can use mantras to get what you want. You want more money? Use a mantra. You want find the perfect love? That's a very low manifestation. And in my mind, a misuse. I mean, we should be able to materialize what we need in this world through our willpower and through our concentration, because we are in control more than we know. But
uh-huh.
So I think that unless one is and what I mean by intention is pure is of service to the world. In other words, these mantras are meant to be used in service, not for personal gain. So the sages who were living at that time were using the mantras to create plenty for the people, to make the forest flourish, to keep the harmony in the forest. They were using the mantras for the well-being and for the thriving of communities of life, not for their own personal advancement. Prema, the sister of the sister that you mentioned, she was in charge of protecting the community. There weren't not from the animals, but there were unsavory tribes that were coming in that were demonstrating some aggressive tendencies. I mean, this was a declining period. It wasn't the height of the golden age. It was a period of loss, of knowledge loss. And so there were these
uh-huh.
unsavory communities coming in. And so she was meant to use this mantra to protect life and to make sure the harmony, the balance of the forest was maintained. But she fell in love with someone from that other dimension and used it to enter in. And then because she had misused it from its original intent purpose, she forgot it when she got there and couldn't return to her family. Today, there are people who can do this. There are people who have what they call powers, cities. I think we have to be careful what we wish for. But if we have a concentrated meditation practice, I mean not a haphazard, but a concentrated practice, and we have to meet our needs, you know, if you don't have a job and you need a job, you can do affirmations. Affirmations are a modern form of like a mantra, where you're enhancing the power of your mind to create the circumstances that you need. You know, if you're having a health situation, you can do affirmations to affirm your positive health, your well-being, and there are amazing results from these affirmations. The mantras that were used in the earlier days were correlated, the sound was an ancient form of Sanskrit, which emerged based on universal sounds. So they were able to work with sounds that were primal sounds in the creation of the universe. You know, sound is like in the beginning there was vibration. Vibration is sound. That's what created all that is. So in the beginning was the word. What is the word? The word is vibration. So while we may not, well, the average person, those of us who are you know, busy with our lives, may not know those particular sacred sounds. We can use affirmations. Affirmations are very powerful, and I've heard many incredible stories, health, relationships, work, of people doing, and even, you know, I know that a lot of people do affirmations for peace in the world on a daily basis, just sending out vibrations of love and peace. So I think that what I've learned from this is that we can take greater control of our lives. I mean, people say this, we know this, that we can take more control of our lives. Yes, there are things from the past, from our karma, the conditions, that we can't change, but we can change our attitude and we can change our future.
Well, I tell people all the time that you create your reality by your perspective of it. And
yes.
And it's true. And I think the other thing that you are illustrating with your book is the law of cause and effect, which I think is incredible, and most people don't understand the law of cause and effect. You know, you take an action, there is a reaction to it. And
right.
Oftentimes it doesn't happen immediately, but it does indeed happen. And, you know, you this is a book also illustrating the law of karma. So that you know, you can pay it forward, and you can, when things happen that are so synchronistic and magical in your life, you have to understand there is a reason for it, and it may not be from this lifetime. And
exactly.
You know,
I think that one of the benefits that a guide or a teacher, a sage can do is delay a reaction. I mean, everything has to, the universe is constantly seeking to balance itself. We see that in nature.
Uh-huh.
We see that in the law of physics. The universe is seeking to balance. So any energy put out, the opposite, it has to have its complementary action. And so, but the timing of it is left undetermined. And the timing often happens when we can benefit from it, when we can use it to grow an understanding. It's not a punishment. It's all there meant, it's meant to stimulate our own growth and understanding. And so the sages and our guides and our teachers can help with this by bringing forth certain effects at a time when we'll be able to learn from it. I mean, the whole process of the law of cause and effect is there to help us awaken. People see it as punishment and reward, but I don't see it that way at all. I see it as all there to help us with the awakening process, which is what life is about, awakening to our true nature, to the reality.
Well, the Dalai Lama once asked, you know, who was your greatest teacher? It was that political system that forced him out of Thailand. And, you know, people just looked at him and said, are you kidding? This man made your life horrible. He made you, you know, homeless. He made you all sorts of things. And the Dalai Lama just smiled and said, and he taught me patience.
That's right.
And,
China,
you know,
was his greatest teacher, right. He taught him patience,
and
yeah.
So that, you know, it's, you know, the what appears to be, you know, a sad experience is a wonderful teaching tool. And it's when you see the lesson that it's taught you, and it's always of a positive nature. When you understand the gift that difficulty gave you, and you don't necessarily have to write a thank you note, but you know it kind of loses its impact on you, and you move forward from it.
I agree. I think you're right. You don't have to write a thank you note, but you can acknowledge that this is a great teaching, and you learned something.
Yeah.
Of great importance from this experience. And I think most of our challenges in life, we don't see it when we're in it, but afterwards, often we look back and we can see how it made us stronger, how we grew from that experience. You know, and people have relationship breakups and they, you know, bemoan the fact, and then later on they say, wow, that was a blessing.
<You know? laughs> I dodged a bullet there. Well, yeah, and well, how about when you come across someone that you know that there is a powerful connection there, and you can't put your finger on what it is, but it's almost magnetic, and you can't explain it. Is that sometimes, I'm not talking, you know, so much of a physical attraction as a spiritual drawing that it just feels like you belong together and you can't explain how or why. I mean,
most people have some experience that you can only explain through a past life connection,
uh-huh.
whether it's a very strong romantic relationship or, you know, work partnership or, you know, it could be a troubled relationship or it could be a beautiful relationship, but you know that it's not the first time. It was a second marriage for both of them, and they both had children in the first marriage. They came together later in life. They were both on the spiritual path together. I always held them up as the one couple I knew that really worked. And they said to me, we've been working at it for many lifetimes. This is not the first lifetime. This is the lifetime we finally got it right, you know? So, but they may have had, you know, several other times together which were not so harmonious. But this time they were at the perfect stage in their spiritual development where they could really work. They were both artists, so they were very independent from each other, and yet it was a beautiful balance between being together and yet having your independent life, which is rare to find in a couple. Usually people struggle with that. Very often people struggle with that.
I think so, that, you know, you've illustrated, you know, it, with all of your books, how people do cycle, you know, so that there is a soul family, so to speak,
and
that they take on different roles at different lifetimes in your life and of course they're on journeys within their own lives as well. So it's almost like there's an agreement that, you know, I'll help you this way, you'll help me that way, so that there's always a balance. And that it's fascinating to me how people do cycle through your life, and not all people are there the full span of your lifetime, but they are helping you to gather wisdom, knowledge, and experience. And
yes, we you're right, we do that with each other. We come together. I mean, it's interesting. The book that I've just finished picks up some of the pieces for When the Bright Moon Rises.
Uh-huh.
It takes place in between the first part of the book, Vedic India, and the second part, Tang China. It takes place in an in-between point and picks up some of the threads. And so it showed me that karma created one lifetime may be partially fulfilled a few lifetimes later, and then other
uh-huh.
parts of that may be fulfilled a few times later, and then other parts of it may be fulfilled at another point in time. And so it's very complex, actually. It's beyond what the logical mind can really follow, because
uh-huh.
there's so many moving parts to it. There's so many pieces to it. We've had so many lives, so many relationships. And one of the things that I've learned from all of this is that I have to be more mindful of the way I live today, because I am today creating my future. What I'm doing right now and tomorrow and the next day will determine the future that I have. And so you want to do that more consciously. And so I'm always saying to myself, you know, I don't want to leave this relationship unfinished. I don't want to leave something undone. I want to make sure that there's completion here on this. because if you take rebirth, it should be out of a sense of service for humanity, not compulsion because of desires from the past. That's at a certain point in your spiritual journey, that's what you aim for.
Yeah, and I think so many people forget that this is not a one-shot deal. That this is we're on a long journey here, and that there is that element of being of service, and it's the spirit that is growing, not the personal individual, not the ego that is with you for this lifetime. That's not the purpose of the lifetime, and sometimes you have to tell the ego to go to the movies and, you know, get out of the way, because, you know, while the ego is just for this lifetime, it becomes selfish for this lifetime alone, and your spirit is here, you know, for all eternity, evolving and going in new directions, and we have to work through or around or beyond the ego in order to get to where we're going.
We definitely have to, yes, we definitely have to manage the ego. And I think we also, I mean, when you see so many different lifetimes, you realize that this is not our home. We may be here for 60, 70, 80 years, and then we may be in that other dimension for 200 years. It varies each time. And so which is our real home, you know? We get so attached to here, but then when we're there, this seems like a dream. So it's, I mean, we have to awaken the other parts of ourselves so that we see ourselves as multidimensional beings.
Well, you know, I found the first book amazing. And you know, I fell in love with each lifetime as you had them, and I just didn't want you to die because I was so involved in that particular lifetime. And then you died, and then you came back in another one. And then it was, okay, well, let's stay with this one for a while. And it became such a process for me to actually, it was almost painful to move lifetime to lifetime because I was so integrated into that. You made it, you were not telling a story, but you were taking the reader into becoming a part of the story. And you did that with the second book as well. So that you became so involved with the personalities and the characters that you didn't want to move beyond, and yet, yeah, by then you knew you were going to move beyond because that's what you do. And so, in this book, I found it, you know, as intriguing, and I loved the way you brought in some parts of the mythology that is a reality if you're evolved enough to see it, with the hermit and everything. I thought that was fabulous. I thought the Taoist hermits, you know, who lived on the mountains and you know, what were their practices and their beliefs. And, I mean, come on, you wrote a phoenix and a tiger. I mean, get out of here.
Well, it's true that I didn't know much about Taoism before I wrote this book, but I found that I became a Taoist, and I got back into my Taoist persona. And I had no connection to China until suddenly the door opened, and I fell in love with Chinese poetry, and I became that personality of that era, and it was hard for me to leave that. Actually, I mean, I had trouble finishing that book. Not that it wasn't finished, it's just that I said to myself, I have to keep editing it. I wasn't making any changes, but I was rereading it and rereading it and rereading it because I was stuck in that era. It's like I couldn't pull myself back. And I wrote this a lot during COVID, actually. I started it before COVID. But, you know, here I was alone in my house living in another time period, going back into several time periods, actually, because I was in Vedic India, and then I was in China, and then even within China, seeing several different lifetimes. So I was remembering a life in which I remembered another life. That was all new to me.
I have a suggestion for you. I know you have a wonderful assistant there who probably has nothing to do part of the time, and I would suggest that you have her gather all of the poetry together and publish the poetry separately.
Huh, that's interesting. Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought about that. The new book coming out has some poems. I mean, it awakened the poet in me, and so I was up in the middle of the night writing poetry, and I just thought to myself, you know, I really became that personality again, and it was just so... I had to pull myself back and say, okay, I'm not living in Taoist. I'm not living in Tang China anymore. Not the 8th century.
Well,
and I'm happy to be me.
Well, yeah, but that personality burned her early poems, and I would really strongly urge you to put out a small, a, a small book of the poetry and add to it as, in other words, open yourself to the poetry that is there because it in itself has a message.
And
if you really have to, then write a description as to what the poetry means, if you feel that you want to put more into it. But I wouldn't think you would need too much to it. But the poetry has
the current book has a few poems, and the book I'm about to start, which takes place in medieval Tibet, actually, also will have some poetry. So I think that since the writing of that book, that door has opened and it doesn't close. I mean, that's the thing, is once you regain a memory, it stays with you. It's you've regained something, you've regained a part of yourself. And so where is this all leading? I don't know. I haven't found that out yet.
have you seen the work of Nicholas Roerich?
Yes. Yes. There's a museum here in New York I used to go to.
I know. I went there too. I got yelled at because I touched the pictures. I just couldn't. He painted with tempera, and he went on donkeys into the mountains of Tibet. And
yeah.
You know, holy mackerel. I mean, and his paintings are so mystical. They are just
so
absolutely
mystical.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I fell in love with his work. Who was it? Not Dorian Virtue. Oh, crap. Now I can't remember her name. Anyhow, she wrote books on the missing years of Jesus and a number of other books. And she was involved in the Saint Germain stuff. Her name will come at 3 o'clock in the morning. But anyhow, his paintings are so, I mean, he uses colors that resonate to chakras that open doors inside of you.
Well, I think he was seeing into other dimensions.
Oh, absolutely. And he and his wife, you know, they were part of the foundation of the Theosophic Society, too. So,
I didn't know.
Yeah, they were very involved in that. And it was because of him that there were symbols painted on top of hospitals during World War II that each side agreed to not bomb.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
He was amazing. A lot of his paintings got sold, and then one of his either a student or someone who worked with him pulled together the collection of paintings that are there in that brownstone in New York City. And I mean, to walk through it's not a quote unquote museum that is, you know, a huge museum. It's in a brownstone, and oh my gosh, when you realize that these were canvases that were rolled up on donkey back and traipsed through the Himalayas, it puts a whole other dimension of understanding of spirit coming graphically to you and touching your spirit graphically. It just opens one up. It's a cool place.
It's true. I think that's the function. The interesting thing about the book that I'm working on now, that I'm finishing, it's again a declining time, which takes place around 1000 BCE, but the arts are just beginning to flourish. So it's almost as if as our doors into the other world, as our intuitive perceptions of the higher realities would becoming less, becoming dimmer, we were expressing our spiritual aspirations through the arts. And the arts then really began to, painting and sculpture and dance and music, began to take on a new role in human society. It was the spiritual connection. And as I saw that, and it was very interesting to me because you can see, I mean, I've always been a history buff, and I've always wanted to really understand the movement of time through history, because I think that we don't really understand it very well in the general public, even in academic circles, see it in a very limited way. But to see the development of human society through a spiritual lens has always been very interesting to me. And I think that, that art was given by the deities as a way to maintain our connection with the higher worlds. And many artists do this. Maybe not the art today. I don't know about that.
Well, yeah, I'm with you on that one. But music especially, too. I mean, if you listen to music from a spiritual sense, there are messages that have been left throughout time. The song Till There Was You, John Lennon's Imagine. You know, a lot of these, you know, forget what they're, I think the magic comes through in the most unusual of channels, which is so phenomenal because, you know, their lifestyle and what they did in their everyday life may not have been of the richest value. However, the gift that they left through time, through their music, is inspirational and just absolutely amazing. And, you know, you change the lens through which you see and through which you hear, and there are spiritual messages all over the place. And it's a matter of, you know, becoming perceptive enough to understand that there is hidden meaning in everything. And if you look for that hidden meaning, it unlocks so much of a spiritual aspect of life to you that it changes everything.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very true. I mean, that was the higher purpose of art. I mean, today it's become much more utilitarian.
Uh-huh.
And you know, there's different levels of art. I mean, there's some art that's social commentary, it's political commentary,
oh, yeah.
But the highest art expresses the spiritual perceptions.
Oh, absolutely. And well, look at. Oh my gosh, Van Gogh. I mean,
he,
you know, my goodness. I mean, what he put on canvas was not reflective of what his life was, but there's magic there. And you can tell, if you walk through a museum, you can tell, you know, where magic was, for me, magic is spiritual energy.
Right. Spiritual energy, yeah.
You know, You can tell where there was magic at work and, you know, weaving an energetic that was going to trigger your spirit to remember or reflect or to go to another time and place and space.
I mean, I think a lot of it is what you said is triggering memories because
mm-hmm.
we all hold the memories of every place that we've been, everything that we've experienced. But for most of us, we can't, in order to focus on our present life, it would be disconcerting to remember it all. And so we have selective memory. You know, we put aside most of our memories so that we can focus on our the present moment.
Yeah, but it's still there. It's sort of like...
Still there. Yeah, still there.
I often, you know, kind of equate our past lives to... our closet, if you had a closet full of all the clothes you have worn in your entire life, and each piece of clothing representing a different time frame, a different lifetime, you know, you could go back and, going back to, you know, your onesies to present time. It's sort
mm-hmm.
of like, you know, remember when we were much younger, I lived in the Northeast, so every winter we had to have a new coat because we had outgrown
mm-hmm.
the old one.
Right.
And So each lifetime, you know, you're wearing a different garment to experience life in a different way.
That's right.
And it's kind of like, you know, you can go through the closet and you can find where some of your stuff is really tattered and worn and other stuff not so. And, you know, some in good taste and some in bad taste. So our lifetimes have been a collection of experiences that have rounded us out to where we are at this moment in time. And, you know, hopefully the wardrobe gets better and better.
Well, I think in the end we will, I mean, at some point we will remember it all. At some point,
mm-hmm.
You know, bit by
bit,
all the pieces come together.
when we transition, when we leave this lifetime, I believe there's also an in-between space where we kind of can take a look at everything we've gathered to this point in time and what is it we need to work on next. And your lifetimes that you're experiencing, you know, sometimes there are thousands of years between incarnations, but there may have been incarnations in there that work on different aspects that, you know, aren't in the same genre that you're writing about. I mean, maybe people don't want to know all of the nasty things you did to get to this wonderful, pure time of peace, love, and, you know, it's sort of like you can't, what was it? It was a Supreme Court judge or somebody, I forget what it was, but they were talking about pornography. And, they asked the judge about pornography, and the judge said, I don't really know exactly what it is, but I know what it isn't. And so it's a matter of you have to have experienced something in order to be able to describe it and react to it. So if we're talking about the horrors of war and murder and rape and pillaging, we've probably been there at one point in time so that we know that this is not a place we want to return to.
Yes, and I think, you know, in my first book, I talk about a life in Africa, actually, during the slave trade where I was raped. And since I was young, I've always had, so that was three lifetimes ago. Since I was young, I've always had a fear of that, of rape. That's, you know, it's just something that that's been in my subconscious, sort of, that comes up every now and then. It was a leftover from that lifetime. A friend of mine asked me, well, where are your lifetimes when you were really a horrible person? And I thought to myself, well, you know, maybe some of these personalities I describe had a mean side to them that I'm just, you know, whitewashing over. I don't know.
I think you're giving, your purpose is giving a message of a spiritual orientation.
Exactly. It's not really about me. It's not. I don't feel any of my books are about me. It's to show how this law works and how growth takes place from one life to the next, and to see the journey of a soul through a long span of time.
Mm-hmm.
The details are less important. Yes, there's a love story in it, and we get to see the power of love, because that's something that I've learned through all of these experiences, is the power of love as a central principle of the universe, as a foundational principle of the universe. It's the most powerful force in the world. And so there are some key messages that come through, and it's less about the detail, you know, who I was in that life and what I did, than about the teachings that I received from, like, the... one of my favorite parts of When the Bright Moon Rises is when, in the first part of the book, when the young forest girl is in the hermitage with Sage Gayatri, and Sage Gayatri is trying to explain to her some of the teachings of the rishis, and of course she's just thinking about the guy she loves, and she's fidgety, and she's not really paying attention, but she does absorb some of it, because that's the way it worked. And most importantly, she absorbed the love of this woman sage, who saw that she wasn't getting it and didn't care. She just was giving her love.
Well, I think one of the important things too is, you know, it is a love story, and it you are also emphasizing the fact that you know, it, love in its totality is spiritual, intellectual, emotional, and physical. It's all of that. It's a complete picture. It's not just one aspect of it. And so that you experience all of those aspects to give you a total understanding of the concept of love. And if one of them is missing, then it's sort of like you're not a totally rounded sphere, and you can't roll true. You have to have the whole package in order to be able to be effective when you're working with other people. It's kind of like, oh, I don't know, I have a thing about, you know, priests having to be celibate, because how can they possibly guide us if they don't understand that aspect of life, the physicality? So,
but, I think that in the earlier times, it wasn't a lifetime commitment, except for maybe the rare few hermits who just went off. But it was a time that you would devote just to meditation. It could be a period of time, 10 years, 5 years, 1 year, whatever. And then you had your household responsibilities that you would then enter into. And so there was a rhythm to it. It wasn't like it, everything became so rigid over time. Social structures became rigid. You had to be born into it. There was no fluidity. The whole monastic thing became very rigid. I think it was much more intuitive in the beginnings of our development of the modern society. It was much more fluid.
Well, in the very beginning, the first lifetime that went way back, they had the leader of the clan was it was generational. It was, you know, mother to daughter.
That
to
was
daughter,
the mother
to daughter,
right. Right. But it was a sort of like an equal society. There was no, everybody lived, everybody contributed to the sustenance of the community and whatever they did best. And there was no real hierarchy to it, although there was a leader that was the woman, there was a matriarch, so to speak, who kind of kept the whole thing together.
I think Native American Indians had the same type of process. There was a shaman that made the major decisions for the tribe, while there was a chief that was in charge, but he took his orders from the shaman.
Yeah.
So that it was there was a spiritual leader, and then there was a physical leader as well. Which was kind of interesting. You know, the shaman, you know, especially when they were migratory, would say when they moved and when they didn't move and when they planted and when they didn't plant. And you know, the male leader was a whole nother, you know, he's the one that kept them in contact with other tribes and things like that. So that
I think the Native American communities maintained a lot of those earlier aspects. They had gratitude toward the forces of nature. They didn't take more than they needed. They kept a certain harmony and balance. And so they were able to maintain a lot of the features of the earlier that I describe, you know. Their relationship with the animal world was an intimate one. It wasn't one of, you know, they didn't see them as commodities, you know.
They apologized when they took an animal's life, and they, especially with the buffalo, they used every part of the buffalo, that nothing went to waste, and it was a wonderful balance. And
unfortunately,
when the Europeans invaded America, they did away with what they considered primitive, which was, in my opinion, far more spiritual than the religion they brought with them.
So I think we have to. I mean, one of the changes in our mindset is to shift our understanding of so-called primitive. What's primitive? I mean, to me, it's primitive to treat animals the way we treat animals. You know, I mean, cows, the meat industry, the cows are skinned before they're even dead. And they're kept in. They're just not treated like life. That's primitive to me. And the kinds of weapons and wars that we have, and tortures and enslavements of people, this is all primitive behavior. So I think we need to, look at our society a little bit more objectively and really see what's primitive, and a different understanding of what's primitive.
Well, I mean, I understand what primitive art is, but even that has a message to give. So, I think it's judgmental. It's assuming that you are better than or no more than you really actually do. And it's sort of like when somebody declares something is primitive, I step back and say, maybe it's not that it's primitive. Maybe it's your ability to perceive where there is a richness or not. that is the primitive thing.
Well, I mean, having more things like the consumption that keeps our society going, because that's really the engine, right? But that
uh-huh.
is that's kind of running the earth toward the end. I mean, kind of using our resources in an unsustainable way. That's I would say a primitive mentality. It's there's no wisdom in that. And so we judge primitive based on technological factors rather than
uh-huh.
wisdom. You know, what's intelligence,
well,
yeah. you know?
Actually, there's a wonderful video out there called Home, and it's on YouTube. And it's probably one of the most graphically beautiful videos on showing the planet and how we have utilized it or misused it, and yet showing how much there is still that you know, we can't spoil it yet, and the Earth is really self-sustaining and has been around a lot longer than humanity has. So that in many ways, but people should take a look at it. It's
Home.
It's called Home.
I think I may have
yeah,
seen
it's,
it. Yeah.
It's a beautiful, beautiful video that has music behind it and it has an audio behind it, but the graphics are just gorgeous. And
I'll
look
at it again.
This planet is amazing, and you know, when you look at where the populations have hovered, you know, along the coastlines, and with the ice caps melting, that eventually we're going to have to be moving more and more inland.
Right.
I have already moved inland. You are going to have to, you know, in a couple hundred
mm-hmm.
years probably.
Right. Maybe sooner.
But it's you know, the topography changes, and yet, you know, we have the experience of being able to still work with the land, still work with nature. And I think what upsets me the most is what we're doing to the rainforest. And, you know, there's so much in South America especially. And, again, because that's never been covered by an ice cap, there's so much hidden there from sight that can give us understandings as to the cultures that were there that no longer are there. And with LIDAR and everything, they're able to finally take a look at, you know, the communities and the towns and the cities that have been covered by the jungle for so long. So that it's there may be a whole other chapter in our history that may predate the last 10,000 years, which is,
I'm sure there
are
many chapters. I mean, you know, we know so little, just like we understand so little about the universe. I mean, even things like electricity, we can observe it. Do we know really what it is? You know, I mean, we don't understand the basic principles, and I think that there's a limit to the logical mind. There some of the sages have talked about what they call the Satyayuga, which is around the time that I'm talking, 10,000 BCE, as the age of intuition, where people were much more intuitive,
mm-hmm.
because spiritual truths are not perceived with the logical mind, with the rational mind. It's the intuitive mind that could grasp it. So it could be that the intuitive mm-hmm. mind was highly developed, the rational mind was less developed, it was less needed. In the passing of time, the rational mind became stronger, and that's what led to the development of our complex societies that we have now. But the intuitive mind got weakened. And so we don't have the ability to grasp these deeper truths. But maybe now the intuitive mind needs to emerge again so that there'll be more of a balance between the rational and the intuitive.
There was a period of time where the intellect just absolutely didn't even respect the thought that there was a spiritual aspect to our reality. And now highly, highly, highly intelligent people are looking into and grasping and understanding the spiritual aspects and the intuitive side of them. And I think that, you know, having a marriage between the intellect and the intuitive is the best of all possible worlds, where they flow together, where they share, where they interconnect so that for the benefit of humanity as a whole. And I think that, you know, the pendulum swings and, you know, we've been all one way and then all another, and it's usually in about that 5,000-year time frame where it swings back and forth, the progression of the equinox is every 26 some and some thousand years. So that
25,000 years. That's the whole Yuga cycle, which they call, which all ancient societies talked about. They call it the Great Year, a complete movement of our solar system through the zodiac. And that helped, that sort of guides the evolutionary process. But I think you're right. I think we have to move toward greater balance between the rational and intuitive minds, and I think we're slowly getting there. I mean, I've begun to think more in terms of long term. We're not going to see everything change overnight or in the next 10 years or 20 years. It's going to be, I mean, evolution takes place over time.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it's interesting to actually be able to perceive the fact that there is a change. We are in one of those swings where the intuitive is coming back into balance with the intellect. And
right.
I think it's amazing because, you know, people who dealt with the intuitive, you know, were looked upon as, burned at the stake, among other things. And, you know, and today there is a greater, of course, the intellect always tries to intellectualize a spiritual concept that has nothing to do with the intellect. It has to do with another level of understanding and comprehension that is nonverbal. So it's a tough thing and it's frustrating, but those who struggle do find it, and those who struggle with it are able to bring it into a greater synchronicity within themselves, and that makes magic happen.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think there are so many things. I mean, when you talk about the sages and the hermits on their mountaintops, now they had magical stuff going on with them, but they'd taken it to an extreme. But this was a time frame where it was appropriate and okay to live on a mountaintop. Today it's harder to do that.
Well, today it's harder to do it, and I think that. I mean, I'm sure that there are still people kind of hidden away. You certainly can see that in India, go high into the Himalayas, and I'm sure I've even heard that even in China there are some. China has a lot of mountains, sacred mountains, and I've heard that there are Taoist hermits who kind of have been under the radar and have not yet been discovered by the Communist Party. You know, so they live kind of apart from society. You know, not many, but I think there always will be such people, but it certainly is harder because modern civilization is reaching almost every place. You know, I mean, you know, and I imagine that will continue unless we see a dramatic shift. And that's, I mean, you can see in India a place that's changed rapidly in the last 20, 30 years, where it's really, you know, it's much more like the rest of the world. You know, development has really reached almost everywhere except the high reaches of the Himalayas. So you have plastic bottles everywhere and, you know, internet and cell phones and all that. But that's okay. I mean, there's, you know, I think all of that, it's neutral. It's not good or bad. It's how we use it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there are areas in Russia, too, that are so isolate that, you know, the people live to 120, 130, and they're healthy and they're vital, and it's because they aren't exposed to what society has done with our culture and with our natural resources.
And they have shamans. I've heard of shamans living in the far reaches of Russia as well, who just stay below the radar, you know. And truth seekers will find them, you know. If you're seeking them out, you can find them.
Yeah, and that's I think one of the wonderful things about you know, books like yours that indicate that, you know, these practices are still there. They're out there. You're able to be a part of them if you choose to dedicate your life to them. And And a journey like this is a dedication of a lifetime. It's not something that you can take a weekend workshop on and have a certificate that says you are a shaman now or whatever. So it's
a commitment of a lifetime, and I think that the practices are much more accessible today than they were in the past. I mean, I think in the past, up until 200 years ago, you had to really go off in search of a teacher. Because mm-hmm. there weren't so many books on this, there was certainly no internet, so you had to go search for a teacher. And now, so many of the teachings, of course, there's no replacement for a teacher, but you can certainly get a lot of inspiration and a lot of guidance, especially for beginning the path, through all that's available between books and online teachings and you know, YouTube talks, and actually this year there's been more than ever.
Yes, we have flooded the internet, haven't we?
It's been a good thing because many more people have access to the teachings then.
Oh, absolutely. And I think personally the fact that we have within us a master teacher ourselves so that it gives us the tools to reach to that aspect of our own inner journey, and you know, that's where the roadmap really is, and connect to that.
Yeah.
And there are so many different ways of making that connection. And it's a matter of trusting the fact that you've made that connection. I think so many people look for a teacher because they don't trust themselves.
That's true. Yeah, they don't trust themselves. And I mean, I think you have to be pretty centered and focused to be able to access your own teacher within. I think most people need some guidance and also, help to persist, because you can get discouraged. You know, people expect immediate results. If you don't get immediate results, especially here in the West, well, you're ready to go to the next thing and try something else. And you do need patience, as the Dalai Lama said, for the spiritual path.
Well,
you need patience and persistence.
I have come to the point where I can now actually walk on water. It has to be frozen, but I can walk on water.
You can walk on, okay.
I can levitate if you scare me enough.
Uh-huh.
I will definitely levitate a micro inch or whatever. But yeah, I think that we can travel in time. We can do all sorts of magical things. It's just a matter of trusting to ourselves and knowing that what we get is going to be instruction for us, you know, for our lifetime.
You know,
mm-hmm.
That's one thing I'm very grateful for, is that, except at the very beginning when I really questioned myself, for the most part, I trust what I see. And I've learned to be able to tell when my experiences are authentic. But it takes kind of tuning in with yourself and really sitting with it and looking at it. And that's been a very useful tool, you know.
Yeah.
One guideline has always been the relationships for me. When I see relationships from the past, and I feel the enormous love that I feel for a certain person from the past. For example, when I when I finished the book of When the Bright Moon Rises, I had a dream of Libai, the poet.
Uh-huh.
And for weeks after, I felt a connection with him. I felt, I don't know if he's in another body or if he's in the other dimension, but I felt his spirit vibrating. And I felt an intense love relationship, a mutual relationship. And I said to myself, this is real. I had to say to myself now, you know, I had the book translated into Chinese. All my books have been translated into Chinese. And I said, Libai is actually a very, very famous poet. He's an historical person. He's a famous poet in China, one of the most beloved poets. And I thought to myself, here I am, an American woman claiming to have been the wife of one of their heroes. The Chinese are very proud. I'm sure they think his wives are still reborn in Chinese bodies, as he would be reborn in a Chinese body. And I said to myself, this is real, because the love that I feel with him for his not for him as a poet, but for him as a man, was so palpable, was so real to me, that that was to me that it's like, okay, this is real.
Yeah, I think that sometimes when you're in that kind of a relationship, when there is that spiritual connection, somebody once said to me, when I talked about things in the spirit realm and spiritual matters, they said, well, where did you learn this? And I said, I didn't, but I know it. And they kind of looked at me and it was like, I can't explain it. I just know it. This is it. This is my truth. Doesn't have to be yours, but it's my truth, and I know it as a fact for me. Now, you take what you want and you move on, but with spiritual stuff, if you trust it and you know it, it is reality.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter if it's, but
exactly. Yeah, I mean, I have been, I would say, each of the book has been books have been a transformative experience for me. I say to people who don't believe in rebirth, well, then just take it as a novel. But frankly, most novels are memories. Most novels are built on memories. What is the imagination? Imagination is based on memory. There's poetic license. We can build up stories around things that have happened to us. Those that where the characters are really real, we weave in people that we've known. I mean, this is how literature, this is the basis of literature, right? It's based on personal experiences.
Right.
Whether we realize them as such or not doesn't matter, But the imagination is closely linked with our memory. That's how I feel.
Oh, to me, the imagination is the well of the combined information, wisdom, and material from every past life I've ever had.
Right.
And so I freely dip into it and utilize it, and I trust it. I trust it more than sometimes the written word, because that's somebody else's truth, and it may or may not resonate to me, but if I have written something, I trust it.
When I wrote the Sita book, which, I really released that with a great deal of trepidation, because the story of Sita and Ram is one of the foundational stories of India. And, of course, I tell it through the eyes of a servant in Sita's household. Sita is a secondary character in the traditional telling of the story, almost a victim of what's taking place. And I was a little nervous of how it would be received in India. Well, overwhelmingly received. Tens of thousands of readers translated into several languages. And it surprised me. It was like, well, because it resonated. Something resonated with many of the people. It's like, well, this is the first time we're hearing Sita's story. We hear about Ram. We hear about, from that point of view. But this is the first time we're hearing Sita's story. And I'm also writing now about the book that will come out in the fall is about Rukmini, the wife of Krishna, and it's the same thing. She's disappeared from history, and yet she's said to be Sita's rebirth, and many of the people who were born around Sita took birth again to be with her. And so it's a continuation of so many of the stories that I've already told, which shows me how everything is linked. All our lives are linked. The people are linked.
Okay, I have a question here. Now, there are lots of people out there that have been, Cleopatra, Mark Antony, Caesar, but I'm wondering, is it possible for more than one person to experience the lifetime of Sita from a different perspective, a different aspect of her character and personality?
Well, I tell the story through a servant's eyes, so I'm not telling it through Sita's eyes.
No, I got that, and that's I respect that. And you didn't decide to be, queen of the world. You decided to be an observer of an amazing
servant.
Person. yeah.
a servant there who was limited in her understanding, but had a lot of the attitude. I mean, at that time, there was a dignity, and this is what she learned from her father, in serving. It was not as we see it today. There was a mutual respect and love between those who were serving and those who were served. It was a different era. It was not a low position, but it was a certain place in society that was essential, right? Some, you know, you get to rotate, you know, through all those things. I'm very grateful that in all my rememberings, I never see myself as a famous person. I was never a famous person. I got to be around incredible spiritual people, and I got to observe, and a lot of it was hearsay through what other people were saying at the time. So if you have all these people claiming to be Cleopatra, and I said to myself after I'd written the book on Sita, was I really that servant, or am I channeling the energy of that servant? Is it that servant speaking through me? I can't answer that. I don't know. All I can say is that I lived that life. If I wasn't that servant, I experienced the life of the servant through whoever's channeling through me. And so it didn't matter to me.
I think anybody who read the book experienced the lifetime with you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what I love about your books, because you have written it to a point where the person who is reading it becomes the character with you. And that is a magic that gives it greater credibility when someone can blend right in with the character and become the character with you. That gives greater validity for me, to what you've written, because I felt it too. So what you were coming from a real genuine place with inside yourself, for sure.
And the people who claim to be Cleopatra, they may be channeling. I mean, everybody couldn't have been Cleopatra, so there was a soul who took that form and then took another form. But many people can tune in with that energy and think that they were Cleopatra. And that's why one has to be careful with this whole process.
Absolutely.
I believe it's always best when it kind of arises organically, and when you focus not on the personality or who you were or all that, but you focus on the teaching. What did I learn from this experience, and what was the teaching that came through to me? I mean, there are a lot of teachings in The Bright Moon Rises, a lot of beautiful teaching from the Taoist tradition. And, I mean, it gave me a new understanding of the Vedic tradition, because Indra, who much later in time, by the time of Krishna, got to be this like personified angry god, for the Vedic rishis, he was the light of the higher mind. And so their prayers were for the awakening of the light of the higher mind, not for a petty god to give them favors, to send down rain or whatever. I mean, that was a more, I would say, less enlightened understanding of the reality. So I got that understanding. Aha! I mean, the word in this is, these hymns all came down in ancient Sanskrit, and they were poems. The word for light is go in Sanskrit, but it's also the word for cow. So the way the Western academics have interpreted, was these ancient Vedic people were just begging, praying for more cows. That was how they wealth was cows. They were invoking the light.
Right. Okay. Well, and that shows you how things can get changed in a heartbeat, and misinterpretations being let out there, because I love the fact that basically it all is coming to the light, bringing light to the reality, understanding and wisdom, you know, to enlighten one. It's so meaningful, and you know, your books certainly do bring that quality through. And I have thoroughly enjoyed all of them in different ways. The first book. I mean, and I think people should read your books in order, to be honest with you.
I agree with you there. Yeah.
Because because you're introduced to the past life experience in the first book, and it's charming and it's wonderful, and you're flowing with the characters. And then the second book is more of a theology, book, and then this last book, you're getting more into the nitty gritty of things, which is but you have to understand the past life experience. And you have gently taken people on that journey with you, so that you went from the simplistic, the cool stuff to, oh, here's a philosophy. This is different. And this book was different yet. But you know, you've educated people through two other books. So this is no leap of faith at all.
Because by the time you get to this last book, at least the second part of it in China. There's already been quite a lot of experience and a deepening of understanding. So she's ready. I am ready for spiritual teachings in a way that did not happen previously. So this may be the beginning of a real. You can see as she remembers her. So she's sitting in the cave under the guidance of her Taoist teacher, remembering two previous lives, which were all a preparation for the teaching that she's getting now, really understanding the Taoist truth, which is universal. And so
this
is what's interesting to me. As I looked over my history, I've seen that there have been early lives where you're just in harmony with things, but not really understanding the spiritual truths, but feeling the love of the great ones, and being receptive to that love, but with not great spiritual insight. And then over the course of many lives, slowly that's the desire for spiritual understanding awakens, and you want to learn practices, and you want to go deeper, and the search begins, an earnest search begins. But that happens over many lifetimes. And so they say those of us who are on the spiritual path now, it didn't come overnight. It's the result of many lifetimes of struggle.
Well, and I loved in this book the fact, I loved the first lifetime. I mean, she was so, I could relate to her. I want it now.
Right.
And
Why can't I have it?
Not only that, but I'll do this for a year or so if I get closer to what I want. And it was, you know, it was being exposed to material that she refused to take on in order to get what she wanted that particular lifetime. And she threw a temper tantrum. I mean, I could relate to the temper tantrum. I could relate to the whole thing.
I could too, obviously. Yeah, she was so hurt by what happened to her that she, you know, was going to get back. She just had to let it out, you know, and she let it out by taking a sacred vow not to see that man for 10,000 years.
I mean, happily it ended well. But actually, it ended in a way that I didn't expect, but I kind of expected. I mean, when she came 10,000 years later to have a lifetime with him, it was wonderful because each of them had their own, they had gotten to a point where they knew who they were and what they needed in life, and he needed to travel and see people and write poetry, and she needed the isolation for when he was away, and yet when they came together, they basically had a physical reality that fueled them for the times that they were apart. I mean,
right.
It was beautiful.
And, yes, and she had to get over her feelings of rejection. She had carried with her a sense of rejection, and her teacher helped her get over that. And this is the interesting thing about karma. We think about it as, you know, relationships and work and health and all that, but it's also patterns of thinking. And they're sometimes very subtle, the patterns of thinking that we have an instinctive reaction to something, you know. That's a pattern of thinking that we've carried with us. And it takes conscious will to change a pattern of thinking. If you have low self-esteem, you know, you have to work on that, you know. It doesn't automatically, I have low self-esteem, I'm going to get rid of that. You have to really work on it. And most likely that's something that you've come into this life with, that you've you've had past experiences that have created that perception in you. And so she carried with her a sense of rejection because she had been rejected in her earlier encounter with him. So she felt rejected, she felt rejected. And so that came back, and she had to overcome that, and that was progress, to be able to overcome that.
And what I found fascinating was that at one point she asked her teacher, she said, did the man from the first lifetime, did he ever marry? Did he ever find someone else that he, she married, and she had a family, but did he?
Right.
You know, and it was kind of like, I want him to have suffered.
Yeah, right. I mean, she's married to the man now. She's married to him. But she still wants to know in that life, did he marry
him? I mean, it's so human.
It's very human. And I mean, she was who she was. I mean, she still had a long way to go.
Well, yeah, but who doesn't?
Who doesn't?
You wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
You would not. You wouldn't have these wonderful lifetimes to reflect back on and say, okay, so that's an aspect that maybe I'm working on now. If it came up in this, possibly, but it's sort of like if you have a sense of humor about the things that you've been through, and you can take joy and laughter from sometimes struggle and sometimes tears, but understand that it made you the person you are today. And most of us really like who we are. So that no matter what I've been through, I'm grateful for the experience because it got me to the here and the now.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, looking back, you can say, it's like, you get a divorce and you look back and say, thank God, even though you might have been tormented during the process and, felt rejected and all of that, things have a way of working out. And when you look back, there's usually gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
If you really can see things clearly, you can see that everything that happens in the universe is for our benefit, is for our higher benefit. Not to satisfy the ego desires, but it's for the higher benefit. Everything that happens to us, and we—it's very hard to keep that in mind all the time. when you're going through a struggle.
Yeah. No, thank you notes. I think that in a lifetime yet to come, I might even write a thank you note here and there, but I haven't.
It could
yet
be a general thank you to the universe.
Well, it's kind of like, it could be something like with the Peruvian shamans, sometimes they do the despachos and you can write the note and then you burn it and then you scatter the ashes. I might do that.
Well, that actually is a good thing. There is power in ritual. Like at one point, Xu, in her Chinese life, takes her poems and she's going to put them into the river. And it's like she wants to send away her past lives, all her recollections. She wants to send them away. And then actually she writes one poem about that, about letting her past lives just go into the distance, not to be burdened with them anymore because she's outgrown them. That's sort of the balance that we have to find, is to be cognizant of our past, but not to be burdened by it.
Oh, absolutely. And, I'm sure everyone can say, yes, I've had experiences in the past that I'd like to forget. Well, I don't want to forget them because, they were part of the building blocks for where I am today.
I feel the same way.
And as far as past lives go, I am fascinated with them. And, I certainly am going, I'm not writing novels like you do, but I am going to take time to go back and to sort of pull out those past lives that are affecting me most at this point in time. Because I think it's a wonderful form of self-therapy.
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's a form of self, and also it brings clarity on what your work is in this life, where your focus should be, and not to be lackadaisical about it. I mean, we can drift through so many years of our life, and then before you know it, you know, you're at the end of your life. So to make good use of your time, I mean, the more awake we are, the better use we can make of the time that we have here.
Well, theoretically, we are supposed to. Well, our bodies are supposed to last us 120 years. So, you know, that gives me another 50 years to play with. So, you know, not sure I will make another 100, you know, another 50 years, but the potential of the human body, you know. Well, I would love to traumatize great-grandchildren. I would love to, you know, be able to give, you know, a lot of my descendants yet to come, or my children yet to come, my grandchildren and great-grandchildren and stuff like that. I'd love to be a voice there that says, what if, you know?
I hear that. I feel the same way. I mean, I think at a certain point, well, you know when your work is done. When your work is done, you move on. And until that time, I mean, if there's still things to do, then you want to stay around in a healthy body so that you can do them.
Absolutely. Well, it's funny. About, oh, gosh, maybe 40 years ago or so, I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. And they told me, and it was really funny because at the time, I wasn't as integrated into this work as I am at this moment in time. And they said, you know, you're going to die of this. You know, we don't know how long you've got, but it's not a long time, so you should get yourself in order. And I looked at the doctor, and I said, oh, I don't have time to die. I have too much to do. And he looked at me, and he said, are you hearing what I'm saying? I said, I heard what you said. I do not have time to die. I have too much to do. And, you know, now I am 40 years, almost 50 years, you know, beyond that. And, you know, there is no sign of ulcerative colitis and stuff like that. So that it was a matter of, you know, I got a death sentence and I said, I don't think so.
Right. Well, that's also the power of the mind. I mean, the power of the mind. We have much more power and control than we realize. Most of us don't use it, you know, don't know how to use it, the power that we have within us. And I think so many of the teachings today try to help people understand the power that they have to shape their life, you know.
Well, I know at the time the doctor said to my mother, you know, she is really not in her right mind. She doesn't know what she's saying. And my mother looked at him, and though she was not spiritually oriented at all, she looked at the doctor and said, I think she knows more than you do. And, you know, which surprised me because it was not like my mother to say something like that. But that I think everybody has times in their life when something like that happens and they make a choice.
Right.
And
they make a choice.
You know,
And
at that particular point in time, no, I had too much to do. I don't have time for that. I reflect back and I think, holy mackerel, where did that come from? Oftentimes things come out of your mouth that you don't expect.
Well, I mean, intuitively, you just say what you know. And it bypasses the rational mind, you know. It's just you know that intuitively. And it comes out and you say it, and then it's like, oh, where did that come from?
Right? Yeah. Yeah, that happens to me frequently, and it's really kind of fun. But, you know, it's, again, being sensitive to the fact that our higher consciousness, our spirit within, whatever you want to call it, does speak to us through intuition, through our imagination, does give us messages from those other realms. And if we pay attention to them, again, magic happens in your life. And everyone is capable of having magic happen in their life. It doesn't have to
everyone.
Be analyzed and
As a matter
taken
of fact,
apart.
Everyone has magic in their lives. They may not recognize it. I mean, there's not a person who doesn't have a guide, a spirit, you know, a spiritual guide, who hasn't been saved from something. It could be a near car accident. How many of us have had a near car accident when suddenly your car is just pushed into safety, you know. There's so many interventions that we have in our life that we don't even recognize. You just go, whew, that was a close one, you know.
Yes.
without thinking that, well, there was some help there. know, and I've seen that so many times, and it just, you know, it's just, you have to just say thank you, you know. Acknowledge that there was help being given.
Well, and the more you acknowledge it, the more that you give it credence, and you know, if I tell people to keep a journal of synchronicities and things like
yeah.
that, because that's when you write it down, you cement it into reality, and you let the other side know, I got it.
Exactly.
And,
you cement it into reality, and you're making a conscious connection with beings in the other, in another dimension, rather than just, you know, not being cognizant of it. You're making a conscious connection. And that's important, you know, as we move toward becoming interdimensional beings, making that conscious connection, which is becomes a theme in my next book, actually. It shows up a little bit in this book with at the end with Satya.
Mm-hmm.
See, had there not been in the first part of the book the exile, had she not been sent away, and met Kapila, who was to play such an important role with her later on, and that becomes clear in my next book, actually, the role that he was to play with her, and their relationship, which unfolded over many centuries. So it's an ongoing saga. There's no end to the story. There's always another chapter.
You know what would really be fun is at some point in time playing with the thought of writing about a future lifetime.
Actually, I have already started to think about that. That's
yeah,
already been... I'm just at the beginning of starting this new book on medieval Tibet, 13th century Tibet, and then I thought to myself, as I do after every book, I don't know what comes next. I have seen two future lives, and I thought but I don't see a lot of detail in them. I just see myself, and I see where I am, and I see some relationships that are formed. I thought of trying to write something about that, a lifetime yet to come.
Yeah, I think that would be so much fun to do because, of course, you'll never know. Well, you will when you get there, but it would almost be a message to myself from the past to the future.
Exactly. Exactly.
And
yeah.
And if you publish it at some time in the future, not obviously a book, but a PDF or a Kindle or something in the future, whatever they use, wouldn't it be fascinating to say 200 years, 500 years from now, someone finding a copy of it and realizing that they are you?
Well, you're actually speaking just what's gone through my mind 6 months ago, because even the books that I've written, I've thought to myself, when I read these books in the future, will I know that it's me? And then I thought somewhere deep inside I would, even though it's not conscious. But the book that I'm thinking about is 200 years in the future. And there are many changes on the earth, and that would have to get into climate change and a lot of the shifts that will be taking place. And I thought that there might be a teaching in all of that because, you know, in my other work, I work with a lot of young people, and I say to them, humanity needs to enter a visioning process now. I mean, all traditions have this, a visioning process.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's about your own life. But a collective visioning process is what kind of society do we want in 50 years, 100 years? What kind of society do we want to move toward? That's a visioning process.
But
you have to have a vision before you can begin to actualize it.
Most of us in school read 1984. I mean,
yes, that was a dysfunctional vision of the future.
Yeah, yeah, it was. But,
and we actualized it. We created it.
We absolutely did. So you know, looking forward 200 years, and then maybe 500, and then maybe 1,000. The Rendlesham Forest UFO experience theoretically had the drone that appeared in Rendlesham Forest. One of the soldiers touched it and was downloaded with ones and zeros, which turned out to be binary code, and it turned out to be a message from 800 years in the future.
You're kidding. A message from 800
years? No.
This is a true story?
True story.
What was the message?
Well, it said something about the human experience continues, that they had been observing us, and
yeah.
that the date that the drone was sent was 800 years in the future. And there was apparently
wow.
more to it, and there are books yet to come. But
wow.
Yes,
what is this
the
book
binary,
called?
I'll send you, it's by James Patterson, I think. And he was the soldier that touched the drone that got downloaded with the binary code. And years later, Linda Morton Howell saw the notebook he had written it down in, because he didn't realize it was binary code. And it was translated, and that was the message.
That's
I think there
really
was more to it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, kind of nice, you know, when I talk to somebody who's in, like, New Zealand, it's fun to know that there is a future because they're already a day or so ahead of us. Knowing that
yeah.
humanity is still being observed 800 years in the future is comforting to a point, but we don't know exactly where the drone came
from. Well, I think
humanity
is going to survive. I mean, that's a wide open question. I think it will survive. It's an open
mm-hmm.
question of what that will look like. We'll adapt to Earth changes. There's always Earth changes. I mean, Earth is continually
oh, sure.
changing. And we're adaptable, but you know, and it may be the Earth won't sustain the current level of population. We don't know what it will look like yet, but I think we can begin to see it. Clearly, seers can see it. So each
absolutely.
One of us has that seer capability within ourselves. We can begin to see it. And that's why I think this time of solitude has been so useful, because when you're out so busy running around doing this, that, and the other thing, your faculties are focused on the external world, not focused on the higher capabilities. So, yeah, we need to begin to awaken our seeing faculties.
Oh,
both the
totally
past
agree.
And the future. Yeah.
I mean, your past life stuff is fascinating as heck. First of all, I would love to see the poetry book, because I think that's called for. Because
yeah, I will do
I
that.
Think
I will, thank you. I will do
your,
that.
Your poetry from then should be published now, so it gets the attention it deserved then.
Mm-hmm.
And with mm-hmm. with the fact that your books are out there and are so popular, you have a built-in audience for the poetry.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I'm going to work on that. I'm going to work on that.
I think that'd be but then a future lifetime or so. That would be fun,
that would be
too.
After the Tibet book will be a future lifetime. It's funny, because this is what's emerged for me now. I never used to think beyond the next book. And each book, it's like, I don't know what comes next. And then
yeah.
something comes. but that's been emerging for me, that I've done a lot of exploration of the past. I've really dug in deeply, and now it's time to look at the future. And wow, a message
yeah.
from 800 years in the future—that's interesting.
Yeah. And where else was there? Bosnian pyramid had some glyphs on it that were interpreted from almost 40,000 years ago, that had to do with stargates opening. So that
stargates opening. Wow.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Cool stuff. If you go online and you look for Bosnian pyramid. If you look on YouTube for Bosnian pyramid, you get Dr. Sam Osmanovic, and he talks about the Bosnian pyramid. He talks about the glyphs that were on one of the stones and the message that they gave. So and they used the term Stargate on the message, which was really phenomenal. And the Bosnian pyramids are phenomenal as well. So have we been around longer than we think? Absolutely. And
well, you know, it's interesting. In my digging into this Tibetan past, all of the memories that you're holding in the collective is that the source of the Tibetans is non-human source. The tribes came out of non-human sources, so there are two ways to look at that. One is that the deities from other dimensions came and seeded the race, right?
Uh-huh.
Another way to look at it is there were star beings that descended, and I tend to think of them as being from another dimension.
Yeah,
they had
too.
Powers. They had psychic powers, and that's how this whole fascination with cities with powers has gotten into the Tibetan culture, because there are original stories of these beings that had powers. They could fly. They did all kinds of things.
Well, the Vimanas and everything, sure.
Yeah.
No, I'm right with you. I'm not sure I buy the, you know, from dust and stuff like that. I think we were put here fully humanoid and interdimensionally seated here for some reason.
Yeah.
So, and then that's
so
my
I'm going to explore that
this week.
A little bit in this next book.
Oh, how cool!
Yeah.
No, I think
you have to pay attention to these things that are in the collective memory of a people.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, it's like
and,
with the
yeah.
Vedic people, it was the relationship with the sun deity. I mean, there's a lot about that in the Bright Moon Rises. With China, it was the moon worlds.
The Egyptians, you know, were sun worshippers as well. So that, you know, and then we go from into monotheism. So humanity has tried to evolve and misinterpreted it along the way. But I think that the core truth has always been there. It's just a matter of going back to the core truth and the golden rule
and all those concepts. And getting rid of all these misunderstandings, you know, like the idea of a judging deity. I mean, all these misunderstandings that have been used to manipulate people, really, to keep people in a state of fear, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of that is being shed now. I think people are rejecting that. That's why there's so much moving away from doctrine and organized religion. It's like enough already. We all have the resources to find our own truth. We don't need anybody to be dictating to us.
Absolutely. And I think that it is an exciting time to be here. Glad I chose it. Glad you chose it, and I just saw the time. Please, everybody, check out her 3 in sequence as well, because it's really, it gives you a better foundation and a better way of looking at life. And each and every one of them has amazing messages to them. And what is the website they can go to?
So I have an office page on Facebook, which is Dina Miriam Authors page, I think, or public page, but I think it's authors page. My organization has a website, which is the GPIW for Global Peace Initiative of Women.org. I'm on, best way to reach me is probably on Facebook.
Okay, and I'm looking forward to your next book, and then the one after that, and the poetry book. And,
yeah, so
you know,
to
that'll
more
keep
to
you
come,
going for two years.
More conversations.
Yeah, we'll figure out where you go next. It's going to be a very exciting journey, and I'm so glad to have traveled with you through three books so far, and hopefully another three or four as we keep going forward. So thanks so much for spending time with me today and my audience, and looking forward to talking to you again soon.
And thank you so much. It's been wonderful.
My pleasure.
Be
Take
well.
Care now.
Talk to you soon. Okay. Bye-bye.
Absolutely. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And thank you. Thank you, everybody. So glad that you were here to share this amazing afternoon with me. It's going to be one that I'm going to listen to again, because she gave so much information. It was a little overwhelming here and there. But, you know, that's the joy of being able to listen over and over in archive. This will be up on YouTube shortly. And please know that you can listen to it there. If you enjoy what you hear, please, the YouTube channel link is on BarbaraDeLong.com. We have other shows coming up. Check our calendar on BarbaraDeLong.com. And if you enjoy this, please subscribe to the YouTube channel. That's the only way we know you're actually listening. Have a great day now. Be well. And celebrate the joy and the love that is around us all the time, and magnify it and share it. Evening now.